A couple months ago, in August of 2025, the Israeli government approved of a brand new settlement plan in the occupied West Bank that stands to destroy whatever remaining hope there was of the two-state solution ever happening. Called the E1 settlement, it'll encompass an area of about 12 square kilometers and result in the forceful displacement of the roughly 2,500 Bedouin Arabs who currently live there. In their place, the Israelis plan to construct 3,400 new housing units for Israeli Jewish settlers, and up to a total of 15,000 new housing units in the future. It is the largest new settlement that Israel has approved in the occupied West Bank in decades since the 1990s. But it's not the science of E1 that threatens the future of the two-state solution, it's its location. It is situated directly adjacent to and northeast of East Jerusalem, which Israel unilaterally annexed in 1980 and where hundreds of thousands of Israeli Jewish settlers already live, and just west of another Israeli Jewish settlement in the West Bank known as Ma'ale Arumim. One of the larger Israeli settlements in the West Bank that's home to around 40,000 Israeli Jewish settlers. Thus, the construction and establishment of another large Israeli Jewish settlement at E1 will directly link the two together and create a continuous Jewish urban population area from the west of Jerusalem to Ma'ale Arumim across the pre-1967 Green Line border. Simultaneously, the establishment of E1 will cleave a continuous Israeli Jewish populated area between what is currently the largest continuous Palestinian urban area in the West Bank, which runs from Ramallah in the north down to Bethlehem in the south. The construction at E1 will cleave this continuous Palestinian urban area in the West Bank in half, and as a result, it directly threatens the contiguity of any future Palestinian state that's based in the West Bank. It'll dramatically increase travel times for Palestinians traveling between Ramallah in the north and Bethlehem in the south. It'll effectively encircle East Jerusalem with a continuous ring of Israeli Jewish settlements, blocking off East Jerusalem from the rest of the West Bank, which the Palestinians would like to see eventually proclaimed as their capital. And after the planned additions are made to the Israeli West Bank barrier wall to incorporate these settlements into East Jerusalem and the rest of Israel, the Palestinians of the West Bank will only be left with a narrow passageway fewer than 20 kilometers wide remaining through the Jordan Valley around the city of Jericho for any remaining territorial contiguity between the north and the south of the West Bank. In essence, it's a way for Israel to effectively kill the idea of a functioning independent Palestinian state from ever arising in the West Bank without actually declaring it, and without receiving as much widespread international condemnation, like a full-on annexation of the West Bank would incur instead. Israel's plans to construct the E1 settlement were first proposed decades ago back in the 1990s, but they were frozen and put on hold until recently over sharp international condemnation, including from Israel's greatest international supporter, the United States. The Israeli decision to dust off the old plans for E1 and carry through with them now, despite the international condemnation, are a geopolitical response to the deluge of international recognitions that have been extended to the state of Palestine following Israel's war and conduct in Gaza. Since the war in Gaza began and the catastrophic levels of destruction that the Israelis have dealt to it, the international recognition of Palestine as a state has expanded more than it had in decades beforehand. Across 2024, Barbados, Jamaica, Trinidad and Tobago, the Bahamas, Ireland, Norway, Spain, Slovenia, and Armenia all extended their recognitions towards Palestine, while Mexico took the same step in early 2025. By mid-2025, with tens of thousands of deaths inflicted in Gaza at a minimum, most of the territory's buildings destroyed or damaged, an ongoing credible genocide investigation filed against the Israeli state, and the UN's declaration in August that a widespread famine had set into Gaza, a coalition of Western states announced their intention to recognize the Palestinian state in order to try and revive the shattered momentum towards the two-state solution again. These states included the UK, Canada, Australia, France, Portugal, Luxembourg, Malta, and the microstates of Monaco, Andorra, and San Marino. Almost immediately in response to all of these Western states' announcement, Israel declared that they would be going ahead with their E1 settlement plan in retaliation, as a way to show them that while they could recognize Palestine all they wanted, words and recognitions would do nothing to stop them from killing the idea on the ground anyway. High-ranking Israeli political figures have been clear about the E1 settlement's purpose for months now. At the announcement of the E1 plan's approval in August, the Israeli finance minister and settler himself, Bezalel Smotrich, proudly proclaimed, quote, "The Palestinian state is being erased from the table, not with slogans, but with actions. Every settlement, every neighborhood, every housing unit is another nail in the coffin of this dangerous idea, end quote. And he added that the E1 settlement was going to bury the two-state solution for good. In September, while he signed the E1 settlement plan into Israeli law, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declared that there will never be a Palestinian state, and that the land where E1 will be built on belongs only to Israel. Although, in reality, Israel's plans to kill the two-state solution, deny the Palestinians a separate state, and solidify their own control over the West Bank have been ongoing for a very, very long time, going back decades now. The final approval for the E1 settlement today in 2025 is merely the culmination of these decades of previous events and Israel's own slow, methodical strategy. For decades now, the kidney-shaped West Bank that's about the size of the U.S. state of Delaware has long been viewed as the core territory that will one day make up the future independent Palestinian state. The way that it came into existence begins with the chaos that went down here in 1948. The year before that, in 1947, the UN presented its partition plan for what was then British-administered Mandatory Palestine, carving the territory up between two separate independent states. One for the Jews, and the other for the Palestinians who both lived in the territory, with the holy city of Jerusalem remaining under international administration. The Jews accepted the plan while the Palestinians and the Arabs rejected it. In 1948, war and rampant ethnic cleansing followed into 1949 that resulted in a dramatic shift in borders and demographics to the original 1947 UN proposal. Israel emerged from the war largely victorious, expelling hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their ancestral lands and expanding their de facto border significantly beyond the UN proposed boundaries to what would later become known as the Green Line or the pre-1967 borders, which are the borders that most countries around the world have since come to recognize as Israel's de jure legal boundaries. Egypt occupied this territory that came to be known as the Gaza Strip during the war, while Jordan managed to occupy this territory that came to be known as the West Bank, because it's west of the Jordan River. The city of Jerusalem, meanwhile, ended up becoming divided between the Israelis in the west and the Jordanians in the east, establishing the modern concepts of West and East Jerusalem. Shortly after the war concluded, Israel declared Jerusalem to be their capital, while Jordan also declared Jerusalem to be their second capital, and annexed both the West Bank and East Jerusalem into their own country as well, all of which extinguished the prospect of a separate, independent state for the Palestinian people. Nearly two decades later, in 1967, came another war between the Arab states and Israel that resulted in a decisive Israeli victory. Israel managed to overrun and occupy the Golan Heights from Syria, the occupied Gaza Strip from Egypt, and the occupied and annexed West Bank and East Jerusalem from Jordan. All of these territories beyond the pre-1967 Green Line borders of Israel have since come to be known as the Israeli Occupied Territories, and have effectively been controlled by the Israelis ever since. Two more decades later, in 1988, Jordan decided to formally renounce their territorial claims to both the West Bank and East Jerusalem. In effect, from a legal perspective, leaving them behind as exclusively Palestinian territories that were occupied by Israel, rather than Jordanian territories occupied by Israel. Since then, the Palestinian portions of these occupied territories beyond the pre-1967 Green Line, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, with a capital in East Jerusalem, have been envisioned by supporters of the two-state solution as encompassing the territories that will one day make up a separate, independent state for the Palestinians, that has been denied to them ever since the collapse of the UN's partition plan in 1948. The vast majority of countries around the world, including the United States, have repeatedly called for the two-state solution based on these boundaries or close enough to them as the best method available to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and establish a lasting peace in the region. But for decades since 1967, when they took over all of these territories, the Israeli government has paid lip service to the two-state solution and insisted that its occupation of the West Bank in particular is only temporary, while also steadily working towards making it impossible to ever actually implement at the same time. The Palestinians have consistently maintained since 1967 that they want East Jerusalem to eventually become their own separate capital city following the establishment of their state. But Israel has taken multiple steps to deny this from ever possibly happening. In 1980, 13 years after the Israelis took control over East Jerusalem, the Israeli government unilaterally declared to annex East Jerusalem and proclaimed that all of Jerusalem would remain their own undivided exclusive capital, eliminating any consideration on the Israeli side for ever giving up East Jerusalem to the Palestinians for their separate capital. The vast majority of countries around the world have still never recognized this, however, and continue to regard East Jerusalem as Israeli-occupied territory. And on top of solidifying their legal control over East Jerusalem by outright annexing it, Israel has attempted to solidify their demographic control over East Jerusalem as well, by adopting state-sponsored construction and migration incentives to encourage Jewish Israeli settlers to relocate there. By 1980, when Israel declared to annex East Jerusalem, there were around 40,000 Jewish Israeli settlers who had migrated into East Jerusalem over the past 13 years who lived alongside a population of roughly 120,000 Palestinians. Meaning that in 1980, Palestinians still made up roughly 75% of East Jerusalem's population. But official Israeli policy at the time explicitly aimed to maintain what they called a demographic balance across the whole of Jerusalem, which was most often cited as a government-sponsored aim for as close to a 70-30 ratio of Jews to Palestinians across the unified city as possible. So over the subsequent decades after 1980, Israeli settlement expansion in East Jerusalem increased dramatically, while Palestinian population growth continued as well, although it was often constrained by the Israeli government's housing, planning, and residency policies. As of 2024, all of this growth has resulted in a modern population in East Jerusalem of about 350,000 Palestinians, all of whom live within historically new Jewish neighborhoods built up in East Jerusalem just since 1967. The percentage of Palestinians living within East Jerusalem has therefore declined substantially since 1980 as well, from about 75% of the population then down to just 60% of the population today. Across the whole unified city of Jerusalem today, 57% of the population is now Jewish and just 39% is Palestinian, maintaining the demographic majority of Jews over the whole of Jerusalem as a unified city and strengthening Israel's demographic grip over the whole city, on top of their legal grip through the annexation of East Jerusalem as well. All of which strengthens the Israeli state's ability to deny East Jerusalem as a separate capital to the Palestinians, which has remained a major impediment to the two-state solution now for decades. And beyond the settlement and colonization of East Jerusalem, the Israeli state has been encouraging a vast settlement program across the greater West Bank as well since they occupied it during the 1967 war. Successive Israeli governments ever since then have utilized a combination of economic subsidies, strategic military concerns, and ideological propaganda to encourage the growth of Jewish settlement in the occupied West Bank, which the Israeli government most often refers to in legal documents and military orders as Judea and Samaria instead, a name taken from the ancient Kingdom of Judah and the Kingdom of Israel, whose capital was located at Samaria, both of which controlled large swaths of the modern-day West Bank during the ancient Iron Age nearly 3,000 years ago. The Israeli settlers who have come to the occupied West Bank over the decades are not a single monolith, and they've done so for a variety of reasons. Some of them are truly ideologically committed religious Zionists who believe that settling and colonizing the West Bank is a fulfillment of ancient prophecy and lands that they believe were promised to them by God thousands of years ago. Others are simply economic opportunists who just want a cheap place to live, since the cost of living within Israeli settlements on the frontier in the West Bank is significantly lower than it is within the pre-1967 Green Line borders of Israel. The Israeli state and military, meanwhile, generally sees the colonization of the West Bank from a more secular perspective that is strategically useful, increasing their demographic hold over the high ground in the West Bank that acts as a strategic buffer separating Israel's core cities on the Mediterranean coast from their potentially hostile Arab neighbors. As recently as 1967, when the Israelis took control over the West Bank, the Jewish population in the territory was effectively zero and non-existent, and it was almost entirely inhabited exclusively by Palestinians and Arabs. Today, nearly six decades later, however, more than 500,000 Israeli Jewish settlers live across the occupied West Bank, in 140 Israeli government-recognized settlements, and around 200 smaller settler outposts who live alongside roughly 3 million Palestinians. This has transformed the Jewish population in the West Bank from 0% to more than 14% in just 58 years, dramatically increasing Israel's demographic hold over the entire West Bank with new facts on the ground and making it increasingly difficult and unlikely for Israel to ever withdraw from the West Bank the more settlers arrive. In 2005, the Israeli government made the decision to dismantle all of their settlements in the occupied Gaza Strip and fully withdraw all of their settlers from that territory, sometimes by force. But that only involved pulling 8,000 settlers out of Gaza at the time, while doing the same thing in the West Bank would involve more than 500,000 settlers today. An order of magnitude difference. Relocating all 500,000-plus settlers from the occupied West Bank across the Green Line back in Israel proper by this point would be an enormous logistical, financial, ideological, and humanitarian challenge. And the risk of the more ideological settlers putting up armed resistance to being forcefully relocated would be so great, it would legitimately risk triggering a civil war in Israel. And this is all the point. The Israeli state has known for decades that the higher the population of Jewish settlers in the West Bank became, the more inconceivable relinquishing their control over the West Bank would become at the same time. Many of the Israeli Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank have basically become full-on functioning cities at this point that would be extremely difficult to dismantle, destroy, and evacuate, like Modi'in Elit. The largest of the Israeli Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank today that's strategically located about halfway between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. Modi'in Elit is now home to more than 90,000 Israeli Jewish settlers, and it exists just across the Green Line within the occupied West Bank, connected to the Israeli city of Modi'in on the other side of the Green Line through all of these additional settlements, which has created a continuous Israeli-Jewish urban area that spans across the Green Line into the occupied West Bank, and which blurs the border between Israel proper and Israeli-occupied territory as a result, which is the whole point. In 1993, the Israelis and Palestinians came the closest they've ever come to actually managing to agree on a lasting peace arrangement in two separate states. They were called the Oslo Accords, and the basic gist of them is that they divided the West Bank's territory into three separate zones of control. Area C was to fall under full Israeli military control. Area B was to fall under joint Israeli and Palestinian control, while Area A was intended to fall under full Palestinian control. When this order was established within the West Bank by the Oslo Accords in 1993, it was initially intended to be temporary and to only last for the next 5 years while negotiations towards a final peace settlement and borders continued. However, by the late 1990s, the peace negotiations between both sides broke down and then never recovered. And so this temporary arrangement within the West Bank has remained constant for more than 30 years ever since. Area C, under full Israeli military control, is completely contiguous and makes up roughly 60% of the West Bank's territory. And in many places, it encompasses valuable grazing and agricultural lands that have traditionally been held by the Palestinians in villages within Areas B and A. Any construction of any building at all by the Palestinians anywhere in Area C needs to be approved by the Israeli planning authorities before it can go ahead. And virtually all Palestinian building requests are consistently denied. While large swaths of Area C have been transformed by the Israelis into settlements, infrastructure, state lands, nature reserves, and even military training areas. The supposedly Palestinian-controlled enclaves within Areas A and B, meanwhile, are not contiguous at all and are separated by each other across the rural sea of Israeli control in Area C, which has led to Areas A and B sometimes becoming referred to as the Palestinian Archipelago or the Palestinian Islands instead. These areas containing most of the West Bank's Palestinian population are highly urban clusters, contrasting with the largely rural countryside in Area C that's under full Israeli military control. Transport for the Palestinians between the islands of this legally created archipelago has long been complicated and hindered by the development of Israeli settlements, Israeli military checkpoints, roadblocks, roads reserved for the use of Israelis and settlers over Palestinians, fences and walls and other obstacles deliberately placed in between them. While over recent years, the Israeli military has increasingly launched raids and operations into Area A anyway, despite it nominally supposed to being under the exclusive control and authority of the Palestinians. Jews and Palestinians across the occupied West Bank have also been subjected to two completely different legal systems. Palestinians in Area C and Palestinians arrested by Israeli authorities in Area B and A, for whatever reason, are governed by Israeli military law, while Jewish-Israeli settlers in the territory are governed completely separately by the Israeli civil code, which results in two different populations of people living within the exact same territory, but only one of which actually enjoys usual civilian human rights protections. Which is why multiple human rights organizations accuse the Israeli legal system within the occupied West Bank of being effectively a modern system of apartheid. The origin of the E1 settlement that's making headlines today began back in 1994, shortly after the Oslo Accords that created this system in the West Bank were signed. Successive Israeli governments, including the one of Benjamin Netanyahu when he first came to power in the late 1990s, continued attempting to advance the E1 settlement plan but kept backing down under American pressure. Eventually, in 2004, the Israelis constructed a police station in the location of E1 and began building some roads into the area in preparation for an eventual larger settlement there. But all of the plans quickly became frozen shortly after that due to sharp condemnation from the Western world, whose leaders were, and remain, concerned that the full development of E1 would effectively kill any remaining possibility for an independent Palestinian state to ever be established across the West Bank. In addition to the entrenched permanence of the Oslo Accords system in the West Bank and all of the Israeli settlers and settlements that have been added to the territory since 1967, the Israelis have taken many other steps to further solidify their presence and hold over the occupied West Bank as well. Beginning in 2002, in response to a spate of Palestinian suicide bombings and attacks on Israeli cities that were launched from the West Bank, the Israeli government began the construction of a vast and complicated system of walls and fences across the West Bank, with the stated goal of halting further Palestinian attacks from taking place in Israel. Most of the wall and fence complex that exists today was constructed by the Israelis between 2002 and 2005. But some construction on it has continued since then, and as of the end of 2022, roughly 65% of the originally intended barrier route has been completed, while construction continues along other areas of the pre-approved route as well. In theory, the Israeli government initially declared that the purpose of the barrier walls and fences were to separate the West Bank from the pre-1967 Green Line borders of Israel. But an astonishing 85% of the route that has been built actually cuts across the territory of the West Bank instead, often plunging several kilometers deep into the West Bank in order to incorporate multiple Israeli-Jewish settlements within the Israeli side of the wall, connecting them to the rest of Israel across the Green Line and isolating them from the rest of the West Bank and the Palestinian population there. Other sections of the walls and fences slice off and isolate Palestinian towns from each other and from their surrounding grazing and farming lands, while additional construction along the proposed routes to incorporate further settlements stands to entrench the system even more, further hampering ordinary life for the Palestinians here. Like the Oslo Accords a decade before the construction of this barrier began, Israel has always framed the barrier as just a temporary security measure, and yet, for more than two decades now, it has remained in place and has only grown. During an advisory opinion made in 2004 by the International Court of Justice, the court summed up the situation well by saying, quote, "Whilst the court notes the assurance given by Israel that the construction of the wall does not amount to annexation and that the wall is of a temporary nature, it nevertheless cannot remain indifferent to certain fears expressed to it that the round of the wall will prejudge the future frontier between Israel and Palestine, and the fear that Israel may integrate the settlements and their means of access." End quote. If all of the West Bank is to ever become fully Palestinian within an independent Palestinian state, then what will happen to all of these walled-off Israeli settlements on the West Bank side of the Green Line that are so directly integrated and connected with the Israeli urban areas on the Israeli side of the Green Line? The Israelis also control most of the access to resources in the West Bank as well, especially the territory's water supply, which the Israelis would presumably be hesitant to ever surrender their control of. The mountain aquifer in the far south of the West Bank is the largest natural source of water available in the West Bank, but the Israeli government has imposed strict regulations on its use. While the West Bank of the Jordan River, which is the other primary natural source of water in the West Bank, is entirely controlled by the Israeli military in Area C, and access to the river's waters is prohibited to the Palestinians as a result. And even further, the Israeli pipeline network that supplies the West Bank with water is also completely dominated by the Israeli national water carrier, known as Mekarot. Because of this disparity in who controls the water in the West Bank, the difference in water consumption between Israeli Jewish settlers and Palestinians in the West Bank is astonishing. Currently, Israeli Jewish settlers in the West Bank consume an average of 320 liters of water per day, while Palestinians within the West Bank only consume an average of 88 liters of water per day in comparison. Less than a third of what the Israeli settlers on the same land consume, and below the 100 liters of water per day that the World Health Organization recommends as a bare minimum. And then, nearly all of Israel's policies of creeping annexation in the West Bank that they pursued for decades began rapidly accelerating after Hamas's October 7th attack that was launched from Gaza. As the Israeli military has laid waste to Gaza, much of the world's attention has been less focused on the events taking place within the West Bank, which has given Israel an opportunity to further advance their hold in the name of security and defense. In 2023, largely after the October 7th attack, Israel demolished significantly more Palestinian homes in both the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem than it did across the previous year in 2022, and then it demolished even more of them in 2024. While at the same time, the Israeli government has also effectively ceased demolishing illegal structures and outposts built by settlers in the West Bank since 2023, too. In 2022, there were around 300 reported instances of the Israeli government enforcing construction laws in the West Bank against settlers. But then, across the first half of 2023, there were only 10 such reported instances recorded, and by the summer of that year, the enforcement of demolition orders for illegal settler outposts was halted entirely and has remained frozen ever since. Simultaneously, construction of obstacles and barriers to movement across the West Bank for the Palestinians has dramatically increased. Before the start of the war in Gaza in 2023, the UN's humanitarian agency, the OCHA, reported that there were 565 separate obstacles to movement in place within the West Bank, while in early 2025, they reported that this number had increased to 850 separate obstacles. One of the most notable examples of this is what's taken place between the Palestinian town of Ein Yabrud and the Israeli Jewish settlement of Ofra in the central West Bank since the Gaza War began. Highway 60, an Israeli-built road, runs between the two communities that either Israeli settlers or Palestinians would normally take to travel further north in the West Bank before the war. But after the war began, as a part of the hundreds of new obstacles to travel built across the West Bank, the Israeli government set up a new gate along the on-ramp leading from Ein Yabrud onto Highway 60, blocking access to the highway for the town's Palestinian residents. As a consequence, Palestinians in Ein Yabrud who want to use the highway to travel further north into the West Bank to visit family or friends now have to take a major diversion northwest through an Israeli military checkpoint, which can halt traffic for hours at a time while performing invasive vehicle inspections. Long lines and wait times at military checkpoints like this all across the occupied West Bank often force Palestinians into spending hours traveling anywhere, even over shorter distances. And this leads us back up to the Israeli government's recent approval of the E1 settlement plan, and how it'll be even more disastrous for the future of an independent Palestinian state arising in the West Bank than anything before it. In March of 2025, a few months before the construction for thousands of homes at E1 were approved, the Israeli government approved and budgeted for the construction of a brand new road from East Jerusalem across the West Bank that would be reserved exclusively for Palestinians. The Israeli government has presented this new Palestinian-only road as a way to relieve traffic congestion between the Palestinian villages of Al-Azariya and Al-Zayim by routing around the large Israeli Jewish settlement of Ma'ale Adumim. But in reality, it is finalizing Israel's plans to fully segregate the road networks in the West Bank between Palestinians and settlers. Henceforth, there will be only one major road reserved for Palestinians between East Jerusalem and the West Bank, and one other reserved for Israelis. The rerouting of Palestinian traffic along the new route will enable for all of the Israeli-reserved roads across the occupied parts of the West Bank to seamlessly connect the Israeli settlements together with the Israeli cities on the other side of the Green Line in East Jerusalem. And they also paved the way for the development of the E1 settlement, whose approval came just a few months later. In effect, the new E1 settlement and the pre-existing nearby Israeli settlements like Ma'ale Adumim that'll all become connected together by this new road that'll be exclusively usable by Israelis will cleave the West Bank into two separate halves. The nearly continuous, dense Palestinian urban area from Ramallah in the north down to Bethlehem in the south, ringing around East Jerusalem, that is the core of the entire West Bank's Palestinian population, will become effectively split in half by continuous and firm exclusive Israeli control. East Jerusalem will become further isolated from both sides of this Palestinian urban area ringing around it, and Israel will solidify its control over the high ground around East Jerusalem and improve its ability to defend and secure their control and annexation of it. For any hope of the two-state solution to be even remotely workable in the future, the Israelis would have to withdraw from E1 and dismantle their presence in the area to ensure an actually contiguous and functioning independent Palestinian state in the West Bank. But assuming they don't do that, so long as E1 remains in place, there's probably no real hope for the two-state solution ever actually happening. And Israel's slowly creeping annexation and demographic manipulation of the rest of the West Bank that's been ongoing for decades will probably just continue on happening until a tipping point eventually takes place. Many of Netanyahu's own most senior cabinet members have been demanding the government go even further and just outright annex most or all of the West Bank and be done with it. Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister and effective colonial viceroy of the occupied West Bank, unveiled a plan in September of 2025 for Israel to just outright annex 82% of the West Bank's land, leaving behind an even more severely fragmented 6 Palestinian-controlled population centers at Ramallah, Nablus, Jenin, Tulkarem, Jericho, and Hebron, effectively making them isolated Bantustans that'll be even more reminiscent of the apartheid system that once reigned in South Africa. But taking it that far will inevitably incur major geopolitical consequences beyond what the E1 settlement plan will even do. The E1 settlement plan almost certainly risks jeopardizing Israel's ability to normalize their relations with Saudi Arabia and other Arab states. But outright annexing most of the West Bank would jeopardize its relations they've already established with nominally friendly Arab states like the UAE, too, who agreed to recognize Israel and establish diplomatic relations only a few years ago in return for an Israeli promise to never annex the West Bank and to reserve it for a future independent Palestinian state. The UAE has recently made it explicitly clear that it regards any unilateral Israeli annexation in the West Bank as a red line that it will not tolerate. And doing so would probably risk Israel's relations with other Arab states they have formal relations with, like Bahrain, Jordan, and Egypt as well, furthering Israel's international isolation even worse than the E1 settlement plan will do. And the E1 settlement plan effectively kills the prospects of an independent Palestinian state anyway. So from Israel's perspective, it's just a lower-cost way to do what they really want to do. U.S. President Donald Trump recently said in September of 2025 that he will not allow Israel to annex the occupied West Bank. But in a de facto sense, it's pretty much already happened. Trump cannot promise to restrict the Israelis from doing something that they've already done in all but name. And his administration has made it clear that they will not put up any meaningful resistance against the E1 settlement plan like every previous U.S. administration has done since 1994, including his own first administration between 2017 and 2021. The Trump administration's appointed ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, simply said during a radio interview after the Israeli decision to build E1 was made that the decision was, quote, "a decision for the government of Israel to make, and so we, the United States, would not try to evaluate the good or the bad of that," end quote. Which marks a major departure on this issue from every single previous U.S. administration. More than 60 years ago, back in 1962, the U.S. President John F. Kennedy famously said that those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable. So long as the Palestinians' right to statehood is denied to them by the forces that be, their anger and resentment will continue to fester generation after generation again and again in a constant cycle of violence. And Israel will struggle to continue containing it while maintaining its desired image to the rest of the outside world. The explosion of violence that erupted out of Gaza in 2023 didn't take place in a vacuum, and the wars and chaos that have taken place since then have stemmed from Israel's own decades-long project to systematically deny the Palestinians a separate independent state. Without a solution to the Palestinians' desire for statehood, more violence is all but a certainty. And the question for Israel's government to consider is how well can they continue containing it? And how worth it is continuing to contain it from a logistical, economic, humanitarian, and international relations perspective? There are many, many examples of previous governments and societies in the modern era that systematically denied large swaths of people they controlled their basic human rights, that struggled to contain their fury, only to eventually become overwhelmed after their pent-up rage finally surpassed a boiling point. Apartheid-era South Africa, that denied rights to its black and African population, was eventually overwhelmed and collapsed in the 1990s. The military junta in Myanmar, that has denied rights to its Rohingya and other ethnic minority populations, is currently facing its greatest ever existential uprising. And Slobodan Milosevic's government in Serbia, that denied rights to its Albanian minority population in Kosovo, was overwhelmed and collapsed in the early 2000s. And perhaps most spectacularly in recent memory, the totalitarian Stalinist regime of Romania that systematically denied rights to nearly its entire population was overwhelmed and collapsed in 1989, which was so catastrophic it resulted in that country's longtime dictator getting executed on live television for the entire country to watch. That dictator's name was Nicolae Ceausescu, and his entire 24-year-long reign over Romania that ended with his own televised execution the same year that The Simpsons premiered on television is one of the most bizarre, morbid, and fascinating case studies of power in modern history. Ceausescu literally attempted to transform Romania into the North Korea of Europe, and positioned himself and his own family in the country the same way that the Kim family positioned themselves in his role model in North Korea. Complete with an insane cult of personality that heralded him as a demigod while his country's people rotted and suffered. And because any video exploring his time in power and what went so catastrophically wrong would immediately become demonetized and age-restricted here on YouTube, I made an entire new documentary exploring him in my brand new original documentary series that I'm calling Mad Kings, which will take deeper dives into the terrible personal lives and erratic decision-making of recent, unstable, and darker dictators. And because of the inherently violent and darker subject material that surrounds this series, my documentary investigating the life and power of Nicolae Ceausescu would never work out on YouTube, because it would instantly be demonetized and age-restricted, which means that YouTube's algorithm, which is based around showing you ads, would never be incentivized to actually show the video to you or to promote it. I deal with very large numbers of my videos on YouTube getting demonetized and age-restricted as they already are. And that's why I'll be uploading all of my documentaries and Mad Kings, including this one on Nicolae Ceausescu, exclusively to Nebula, and why signing up to Nebula is the absolute best thing that you can do to support me and my channel. You'll also get access to way more content than just this new Mad King series as well. You'll also be able to watch the nearly 50 exclusive documentaries that I published to Nebula in my separate Modern Conflict series as well, which explore 21st century wars, battles, conflicts, and genocides using a level of depth of frankness that would also never work on YouTube, without triggering demonetization or age restriction issues. This is all possible because the best part about Nebula is that it's jointly co-owned by myself and hundreds of other independent creators to make the projects that we're actually deeply excited about without any fear of being censored or demonetized like we are on YouTube. Because since it's a subscriber-based platform, we don't have to cater around the sensitive needs of advertisers and a faceless algorithm that nobody really understands. That's why there's tons of other new unique content on Nebula that's coming out all the time too that you'll also love. Like Neo's Underexposure series, Wendover Productions' The Logistics of X series, TLDR News' What to Follow USA series, and so, so many others. I also know that there's a lot of streaming platforms out there right now, and you don't want to get stuck with another monthly cost to keep track of. But I also know that if you watch this all the way through to the end, there is so much content on Nebula that you'll also love as well, and so much more coming out with every new month that you could consider a lifetime membership to Nebula. You just pay once, and then you'll get lifetime access to everything that I and hundreds of other creators will ever produce on Nebula for as long as we both last. And then you'll never have to worry about a recurring subscription or ads ever again. Normally, a lifetime subscription to Nebula costs $500, but if you use my link, you'll get an incredibly solid 40% off discount and be able to snag one for just $300 instead. That's the best way possible to support what I'm doing here on Real Life Lore. But even if you'd rather not make that large of an upfront commitment, you can still greatly help support me by signing up for a yearly or a monthly subscription to Nebula as well, which you can get right now for a fantastic deal with 40% off by scanning the QR code or clicking the button here on your screen right now, or by following the link that's down below in the description. Any of which will also give you access to everything on Nebula for the very low price of just $3 per month or $36 a year. I hope that you'll consider signing up, and as always, thank you so much for watching.